You're listening to the Keith Blakemore Noble Radio Show, helping you transform your deepest fears into your greatest strengths. Here's your host, Keith Blakemore Noble.
Hey, hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode. Great to have you here. Now, what are we talking about today? Today we are going to be talking about, overcoming fear of public speaking, particularly from the perspective of an introvert. And we're going to be looking at it via stand-up comedy, speaking professionally, why people are afraid of speaking, and how we can take what we learn from overcoming those fears and apply them in other aspects of our life. You are going to want to listen to this one. This is fantastic. I've got a great guest. I'm really lucky to have Red Staffstrom. Hey, Red, how are you doing?
Hey, how goes it?
Good, thank you. Good, good, good. Just to let people know a little bit about Red. Red grew up as a classic nerdy introvert, something I can relate to very well. I know many, many of you can too. He was skinny, enjoyed reading and video games. In college, on a dare, he entered a stand-up comedy competition, and he won. He ended up going into New York City multiple times per week in order to do stand-up. Eventually, Red needed to focus more on school. It's always the way. And he needed more money than he was able to make as a young comic. So he graduated college in 2008 with a degree to teach high school history. And this was just a few months after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. He needed a job, and he found a fit in sales. Since then, he has tried a number of different sales jobs and learned the ropes of each of them without really feeling passionate about any of them. This was until 2008 when Red connected with Jared James, who is one of the top real estate coaches in the US. Red became a consultant who focuses on helping commission-only real estate agents become the top producing salespeople they know they can be. And there's more than a little of that Red owes to his success as a stand-up comic right the way back when he was at school. So that's my guess, Red. Hey, Red, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. All in one piece. Can't complain.
This is excellent. This is excellent. So we've heard your bio.
Yeah.
But who is Red? Who is he?
So I'm assuming I can't start off with that line from The Jerk that I grew up a poor black boy in Gary, Indiana, but that probably doesn't work considering I'm a pasty ginger. So I grew up kind of in an inner city in Waterbury. It's kind of a depressed manufacturing town. Scrawny kid, you know, just always been the nerd, always been the reader, the introvert. My dad's a chemical engineer. My mom's an accountant. So I've always been analytical, numbers focused, very, very much like how do the pieces kind of fit together.
Gotcha, yeah.
And from there, just kind of moved along and really quiet throughout high school, and then found the right group of buddies in college who kind of pushed me out of my comfort zone as much as they possibly could when I didn't do an Irish goodbye on certain nights because I didn't want to be around that many people and I just disappeared into the night. Yeah. So, but yeah, mostly just, I mean, as I'm sitting here, I still have the Spider-Man shirt on, still love comic books, still love sci-fi, the whole nine yards, and probably until I was in college, weighed about 160 pounds, or let me do the math, about 70-ish kilograms. And then around, like, I think it was sophomore year, we were kind of sitting on the couch. I've never been the funny one to the point where I, like, grab everybody's attention. I've always been the quick one, like the zippers. And there was a contest at my college, $200. They, you know, kind of talked me into it. And from there, I did well. And I just kept doing it. And once I got paid the first time, I kind of decided I wanted to do that again and again and again.
Yeah.
Kept going into the city.
So yeah, it all started as a dare. They basically, your mates basically dared you to enter this competition where you could win $200.
Yeah, that's really all it came down to, is more or less machismo. So the guys that I was rooming with at the time were the classic extroverts. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I like one of my here. And then from there, I was like, all right, why the hell not? And just started writing a script, writing jokes. I wound up pacing on the softball field of my college at 2-3 o'clock in the morning some night, working on material. Yeah. I mean, it was just a 5-minute set. It wasn't a long thing. But for my mind, what I needed to do, being that logical introvert, I knew that I had to over prepare, that I couldn't skate by on charisma like everybody else. Yeah, and I had to like really micromanage every single word because I was so scared about it. Like every sentence, like, is this too many syllables? Is it like, okay, like I'm consulting a thesaurus in order to write a stand-up comedy routine. It was way over preparing fault in our minds that we have. That for years, what's happened is we've been afraid of people watching us. And that's why even to this day, you could kind of feel between your shoulders when somebody's watching you. And having 50 sets of eyes, 100 sets of eyes, 1,000 sets of eyes, and knowing that they're looking, like, it just, like, I don't know how to describe that feeling without just raising and tensing my shoulders.
So you're kind of the classic introvert nerd, and you're about to go on stage to deliver this thoroughly overprepared comedy slot. What's going through your head, and how do you overcome what must have been a lot of fear to actually stand up there and do it?
So I was lucky the very first time. So we did it in the auditorium of the college, and I couldn't see the people at all the first time. That they had the stage lights so bright that the only thing I could see was just white. Like I just walked into the light. But I was able to recite it the same way that I did on that softball field in the middle of the night. Mm. And then I would hear the laughs.
All right.
And I could hear them landing. So something as simple as having the stage lights turned up helped me there. As I started going into New York and doing it in places like the Comedy Cellar in New York City and Stand Up New York, were like nerve-wracking because comedians don't laugh. We work so hard on learning the jokes and learning the setups that we start to learn how to predict where the joke is going. We could see the left turn before it's taken.
Yeah.
So I thought I was bombing in so many of these. I honestly did. And then I'd be up on stage and I'd have my 5 minutes. And at the end, they would come out and say, this is great. Yeah, but nobody laughed. We've got 30 people in this room and I didn't hear a giggle. He's like, no, that was awesome. Like, you killed it. Like, what?
Wow.
Yeah, that's the weirdest part is that. And you start to find out, and it's really weird in stand-up. It's people think it's tough to talk in front of a big crowd. In stand-up comedy, it's actually the opposite. The bigger the crowd you're talking to, the easier it is. Because what happens is all those jokes that are kind of meh, they land hard in big theaters. Like those jokes that you just go, that sounds like thunder in those cases. But when you're in a comedy club with 30 people in it and you hear the dishwashers in the back, that doesn't register to you. So as much as they know, and you could eat, that's one of the reasons why you see so many comedy specials tape in these giant auditoriums as opposed to in the actual comedy cellar, where honestly, yeah, comedy is better. Comedy is way better in those little intimate clubs where you go in, and I don't know how you could explain the feeling if you haven't been there.
Right. I guess they're smaller, more intimate. So you get that closer connection with the crowd.
Yeah. And like the level of crowd work, like as somebody who's done stand-up comedy as often as I have a tough time watching some of those specials now. Mm. Now, before I got into comedy, I was, and I still am, a huge comedy nerd. Like, I could probably recite Eddie Murphy Raw verbatim right now. Like, Richard Pryor, like, all of the classics. Dennis Leary, No Cure for Cancer. Like, all of these, I could probably just spit out without any problem. Because, again, I probably, being the introvert, that was just like sci-fi, video games, comic books. Comedy was just another thing to nerd out on for me. It's just another book where the linguistics are, it's almost like poetry, it's theater.
Gotcha, yeah, yeah.
It's a completely different environment, and I love that about comedy. So for me, when I was doing it and trying to tweak these and learn the timing, that's probably one of the hardest things most comedians wind up learning is being comfortable with silence.
Yeah.
Being able to build that moment. That is, if you watch some of the like early tapes that a lot of comedians have, you can hear them like spit out the line too quick because they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing for most people to get by, is that silence.
Because I guess you need to allow that silence so the audience can kind of catch up with you. And then appreciate the joke and then go, oh my God.
And it's, you need that tension. You need that like kind of awkward feeling. Yeah. But as a comedian, you hear silence and it's like, again, deafening silence. It's almost a cliche, but you just hear the blood rush in your ears when you're doing it. That's the biggest, that's one of those obstacles where like, oh, they don't like me. And you have to get comfortable with that.
Yeah.
So you have to be comfortable letting people just stare at you for like seriously a solid five count for some jokes in order for them to be real, to land. You need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
And you need to know when that's the right time.
I guess that must be a really tricky thing to do, because you've got to allow the silence. But if there is silence, I guess certainly when you're starting, their natural instinct is to go, oh, shoot, they didn't like that one. Quick, onto something else funny. And you start blurting out the next one while they're still processing the first joke.
And human beings, for whatever reason, tend to have this issue with silence. Like, they have to fill it. That's one of those things, like, as I've done sales, that's probably one of the skills that I've really had to like hone and like really make sure I'm paying attention to, because you hear silence and you think, oh, okay, well, always be closing. I have to spit out some product information. So here's some features, advantages, benefits. Come on, sales, say yes, say yes, say yes. No, that's the worst thing in the world you can do, is overshare.
Yeah, I've heard about that, where people basically end up, there's a silence, so they dive in and they end up basically talking themselves out of the sale.
Always
shut up and let the other person think, process. Right, I'm ready to make a decision.
So especially with sales, so I know you do, like, obviously it's all emotional, and obviously all of stand-up comedy, it's all about the emotional unrestricted reaction that you have. It's all about the amygdala and the limbic system. It's all speaking to that reptilian brain that you have. And how do you do that the right way? Because if, like, how many times have you tried to explain why a joke is funny and it crashed?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as you bring it into that neocortex, into that frontal lobe, it's garbage.
Yeah. You've gone from the emotion to the logic side, and humor is an emotion. It's not a logical.
Not even close. So that's one of, that's a huge thing to control somebody's like amygdala and what they're really thinking and what they're like, what the emotion is, while still being rational. Like, okay, I have, this is okay. This is the cue. This is okay. I need to wait. 1, 2, 3, 4. How do you balance all of that? And it's a whole technique for it. And the only way you can learn it is really by trial and error and getting yelled at over and over and over again.
I guess that's one of the really scary things for it. The only way to learn how to overcome being terrified of doing that is to keep doing it until it stops being scary.
Well, that kind of, one of the posts that are the podcast that you did recently about the motivation.
Yes.
How, like, hands on the stove and how it's never as bad as you expect it to be. Like, it's the thought of how bad it's going to be that holds you back from doing it. It's like, I hate to use this reference, but it's like getting punched in the face. Like, it's, again, you don't have a face like this without being hit a few times. Like, you don't look like a troll, now without getting punched a handful of times. You dread the punch more than it hurts.
Mm.
It's that aversion. You dread, the reference you used was running and how when people go out to run and it's rainy and it's windy and it's cold and nasty, how much you dread that as opposed to the shower afterwards.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
So how do you justify those two different things in your mind? And how do you get past it? Like, okay, it won't be that bad. But it all comes down to, like, how much control do you have of your own mind to push back the amygdala, because human beings are so scared and tenuous and worried about everything.
Yeah.
You know,
How do you overcome that? How do you manage to convince yourself, you know what, this isn't going to hurt as much as I fear it will. Let's do it.
So I know it's a cliche, but getting out of your comfort zone. And I hate that phrase because people say it, make it sound like you have to be the Spartan warrior that sleeps on rocks. And no, your comfort zone is just like any muscle. It's just like any area of strength. You need to know when you could extend that muscle and when you have to retreat back.
Got it.
As an introvert, I know I can go to parties and socialize. I can turn it on when I need to. It's no different than a stage performance. But I know if I do that, I need to spend twice as much time recharging.
Yeah.
And spend twice as much time in that, the Carl Jung, that introvert, like, recharge alone as opposed to the extroverts who recharge with people. Mm. I know I need to backtrack and spend twice as much time in order to be read the stand-up comedy as opposed to read the person who I'm home with my wife with. So it all comes down to knowing and extending that comfort zone and getting used to that negative stimulus to the point where it doesn't bother you anymore. When I sold, one of my jobs, I sold door to door. Literally, I created a little like device in my head where once somebody slammed a door on me, it was almost like a key where afterwards I would leave that door. I go, I can't like whistle, but I'd always try to whistle that do, 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 do. But I'd whistle that as much as I possibly can.
Okay,
and that was like a mental reset for me.
Yeah.
So, but you have to learn how your brain is wired through trial and error. Okay, so if this happens, how does this respond? It's very scientific, very engineering based. It's okay, add more, like a carburetor, add more gas, get less gas, add more air, add less air. It's just tuning a carburetor.
That makes sense. I'm thinking back over the whole conversation that we've had, and there's a few things that have kind of stood out from there. Right back to when you were doing that dare and doing that very first comedy thing. What I got from what you've been saying is, or as I can see it, there were basically a couple of really keys there that got you through it. The second one was the one you mentioned where the stage lights were so bright, you couldn't actually see anyone. So, and that does make a huge difference. Yeah. I think the first one was, you described that you were kind of over-preparing and creating much more material than you needed. And you were out pacing at 3 o'clock in the morning on the sports field, practicing it, making sure that you were comfortable with all the timing of it. So it's putting in all the effort, putting in the masses of effort and rehearsing it and practicing it. So you went out on that, on stage, you knew you could deliver it.
Yeah. And eventually you get to a point where you just have that confidence. Like now, I basically have bullet points and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, I recorded a podcast this morning. I literally wrote down the intro because my intro is scripted, my outro is scripted. And I literally wrote content in capital letters in the middle. That was it. That you just get used to it eventually, like you know what the rhythms are. It's just bobbing and weaving at that point. How do you learn like the reaction that you're looking for? And if you are looking for one, how do you foster it? Do you slow down? Do you speed up? Do you build that anticipation? What's their heart rate got to be like in order for you to get the response that you want them to?
Yeah.
If you start speeding up and you talk a little faster, then people's anxiety will go up because something is important to come. But if it's slow, then they're going to relax.
Mm-hmm.
It's all little mind tricks.
Oh, yes. And it's really interesting you're saying those because, I mean, I know about those things as well because of what I do. And even though I knew what you were going to be saying and I knew what the results are going to be, I still feel it as you were speeding. I was like, and as you chill it back down, you can actually feel
yeah.
Even when you know what's coming, it still works. It's so powerful.
It's part of that, and I've done some studies. I want to look into it some more. The neuro-linguistic programming that Tony Robbins is a big fan of. I'm hesitant to really embrace those because of how manipulative they can be in sales. And I believe that you can only burn bridges once. So I'm hesitant to really endorse them, but I like to understand them more as a consumer than a salesperson.
It is a fascinating topic, NLP. I'm an NLP practitioner and trainer myself. And yeah, you're right. People can and do abuse it. But that's the same with any tool, which is what NLP mm-hmm. is. It's a tool. Any tool can be abused. But when you use it correctly, or when you use it with positive intent, it can be really powerful and a very amazing tool as well. So I think you're going to really enjoy it when you start studying that.
And I have some buddies who, obviously I'm in the US, you're in the UK. I don't know the probation system and like the behavioral stairway change model and things along those lines where how do you get people to like exhibit change, whether it's giving up drugs or whatever it is, how do you get them to buy into that? Yeah. Like you can use it positively to get them to do it. I've seen it misused enough times that I'm cautious. Like, a knife is a tool. A knife is like you could cut your dinner with it, but you still have to be careful picking it up.
Yeah. And I think particularly in sales, and this is not having a go at sales in general, but we all know there are particular types who mm-hmm. will have no qualms about misusing whatever tool they can to get that sale. And I think that's where a lot of their bad reputation comes from.
And to be honest with you, sales has earned that bad reputation.
Unfortunately.
For a lot of years, So I've dug pretty deeply into the history. If you've ever read or listened to, I do audiobooks because I'm in the car a lot. Susan Cain's Quiet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. She has a great bit where she digs into the history of how the U.S. particularly became an extroverted nation and how, like, throughout that history, we've glorified the highly charismatic, well-met personalities.
Yes.
And so, but now as we're looking at this, a lot of those sales tactics that have gone for years and years, like hard closing techniques, like that Glengarry, Glenn Ross, Alec Baldwin, always be closing.
Yeah.
Like those, like your pen or mine closes, people know those now, and they know how manipulative that corralling structure, like manipulative clothes is.
It is interesting to observe more and more people are getting, as you say, they're getting to know these, which is an interesting, it's also cool. They're getting to know them so people can't abuse them. But it's also interesting when you still see some people will still keep trying to use that same tech, even though it's obvious the other person knows what's going on and counts it. They just get stuck in that mindset.
Well, that people don't realize how young social psychology with sales is. I don't remember seeing a sales social psychology book until Influence in 1982. So sales as a science is less than 40 years old. And that wasn't even a sales book. That book was written specifically aimed to help consumers when Robert Cialdini wrote it. He wanted it to keep like, okay, these are the manipulative tactics salespeople are using, watch out. Yeah. And then it wasn't until 1988 when Neil Rackham wrote Spin Selling. That was the first time, like, that's the first book I've ever seen, like, scientific studies into the sales process. So these manipulative things, and again, we're digressing a little bit. I want to make sure I talk more about public speaking for you. But again, this is one of those, like, quasi passions of mine where I like talking about how, We've gone astray as an industry.
Yeah, which is a shame. But hopefully, over time, it'll swing back the other way to a bit more of a central.
Yeah, and eventually, there's always going to be a bad actor. That's the nature of the world. But it's just what are the best practices? How do you get to yes in an ethical manner?
Yeah. That's what it's about, isn't it? It's the ethical ethical side, which is missing in many cases.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So back onto the public speaking part, because I know your listeners are particularly interested about that. I apologize for getting a little off topic there.
Not at all.
The big thing to realize, at least that I've learned from trial and error, is you have to see yourself as the person in the seat too. You've never thrown tomatoes at anybody as a watcher. You've never, like, you've probably never booed a screen in your life.
True.
I mean, I know people who clap at the end of movies even though nobody's in the theater. Like, it's not like, I remember I saw that you have the R2-D2 profile picture now. I remember at the end of Force Awakens when we saw it, I saw it opening night. My brother-in-laws are like diehard Star Wars fans, and everybody's standing up and clapping.
Yeah.
People like to support one another.
Yeah, so true, isn't it? Yeah.
And like, sadly, the way we're kind of trained is we have to be cautious. We have to be pessimistic because that's the way we're hardwired. 70 to 80% of people have negative mindsets. And it's built in from like our caveman days. Grog goes into the cave. You can either think the positively, hey, he's really cozy in there, or maybe something ate him. Who do you think is going to survive longer? The pessimist.
Yes.
Yeah. So as human beings, we're wired towards pessimism, towards loss aversion, towards like caution. But we're past those days now.
Yeah.
We're not worried about somebody jumping us when we walk into a Macy's anymore. We don't have to worry about that. We've grown beyond it. So how do you recognize that most experiences are good? Otherwise, they wouldn't exist anymore because we have that kind of power as a society.
Yeah, I guess it's because as a society we've evolved very rapidly, but it takes a lot longer for the mind to kind of evolve and catch up. And we see that in so many different aspects these days because society is evolving and changing so rapidly.
So every decision a person makes tends to be an emotional decision justified afterwards by logic.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure that you're not allowing those emotions to overwhelm you and keep you from doing things that will be ultimately positive. And again, in this, like, I know Western society especially, they reward charismatic people. They reward people who are willing to stand up on a table and say, look at me.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to push past it and learn.
Which kind of takes us neatly right the way back to that introvert. He has suddenly found himself standing up, delivering a stand-up comedy set.
Because there was no other choice. If I want to be listened to, you need to learn how to speak.
Yeah.
And that's just the skill set that the same reason why I found myself in sales. As you were saying, I graduated to be a high school history teacher. Then they stopped hiring teachers because the economy collapsed.
Yeah.
So the job that I was able to get was in sales because they were still hiring. They still wanted sales. And now I'm still doing it because I don't really have another option. like if I could get paid to sit on my couch and play video games, obviously, nobody's going to deny that.
Sign me up.
Yeah. But for me, I have to know that the only way to actually be productive and the only way to like really decide my own fate mm-hmm. is to do sales. So I've had to break out of it. And I saw that as a necessity mm-hmm. because guess what? I was sitting there as accountants were getting fired. I was sitting there as my father, who was a chemical engineer and worked with the same company for 20 years, lost his job because he was getting paid too much. The only option is to learn how to sell yourself. That's, and by getting in front of people and actually being willing to stand on that table or stand on that stage, it gave me the skills I needed. So it was back to your podcast about motivation. That's what motivated me. Because
yeah.
there was no other option in my mind at that time in U.S. history.
Yeah. Got it. Well, hey, Red, we've covered a wide range of topics on this discussion. It has been fascinating, I have to say. I know I've picked up quite a few gems from our chat. I know listeners will have picked up some gems as well. I'm not actually going to summarize them because I think it's more important for people to get their own meanings from these because there are some amazing lessons in there. Some people have got.
And I was chasing squirrels a little bit in there too, that I was kind of all over the place, but hopefully everybody enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, and you say that, but you know, in some way they were linked, they were interlinked, and there was a definite underlying theme going on through there, even though it wasn't one that you or I had planned in advance. It's I'm glad the conversation went the way it did. I honestly believe this is one of those conversations. It's going to repay re-listening to it a couple of times because there's some really.
I hope so.
I would certainly recommend having another listen to it, listeners and viewers. When you get a chance, have another go through this because there are things in there which you will get the second time around you haven't got the first time around.
See, that's one of those things too. I love, like, one of the hardest things that I'm still somewhat struggling with in my, like, even doing my own podcast and doing my own videos is my own voice. And I know when you were talking with Rich on your previous episode, you were talking about the same thing.
Yes, it's such a thing.
So I don't know if you know this because you didn't get to mention it on the podcast. You know the scientific reason behind why you hate the sound of your own voice.
Go for it.
Because when you talk, the vocal cords actually vibrate your inner ear and make you sound a lot deeper in resonance than they really are.
Yeah.
So when I talk, I hear like not quite James Earl Jones, but I'm a lot deeper than I really am.
Yeah.
And then I hear my real voice that everybody else hears. And without that extra resonance that you have because ear, nose, and throat are all connected, it doesn't sound right at all to me. And it's just this exactly. disconnect.
Yeah.
So I would love to read the transcript of it, with that said, but I don't, like, I always have a tough time re-listening to myself. I kind of even skim my own podcast at times.
I used to find that, and we really are going off topic, but hey, what the heck? I used to hate listening to myself or watching myself on video until there was one training I was doing with Dale Carnegie.
Okay.
Doing training with there, and what they do during, there's two solid days where you stand up, you speak and deliver the talk. They video it. They then take you into another room, and you and another trainer watch your video. So you're sat with someone else watching you talking, and you have to work, say what was good about it and what to improve. And the first couple of times, like, oh, I can't watch this, until I managed to flip something in my head, and I kind of almost played it as if I wasn't watching me. I'm watching somebody else. I'm watching another student. And together, we're working out what that other person did well and how that other person can grow. Yeah. And ever since then, I've been able to listen to, oh, it's going to make me sound terribly vain. I can listen to my own voice in my own podcast. But it's kind of this, when you can manage to disconnect from it and kind of, even at some level, just pretend, hey, this is actually somebody else I'm listening to. They sound a bit like me. They say the things I say, but it's actually someone else. It suddenly becomes a lot more comfortable.
Well, it's, I remember reading somewhere that Johnny Depp can't even watch his own movies because it drives him nuts.
Yeah, there's quite a few actors who will not watch their own performances.
And until I started doing video regularly, I would have never understood it.
Yeah. Humans, we are
now strange. Like, okay, like, no, I don't get rid of the orange weirdo that, like, orange Chewbacca, get him off the screen. I don't need to see him anymore.
Well, Red, it's been a fascinating conversation. If people want to find out a bit more about the orange weirdo and maybe get in touch with him, what's the best way they can find out more about the introduction and so on?
So you could find me online, whyhowyes.com, whyhowyes, whyhowyes, just one word. .com. And there you can find everything.
Brilliant. So that's whyhowyes.com. As obviously Red's all over social media. I've got all of his links to all of his social media and links to his website. They're all in the show notes for this episode. As always, you'll find them on keithblakemorenoble.com/show. Look for Red's, the one with Red. You'll find his episode, his bio, links to everywhere that you can find him. If you just want to go straight to a site, whyhowyes.com. Red, right. I want to thank you for taking time out for this chat. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope we can have another chat at some point, because I know there's so much more we could cover.
Yeah, just let me know. I'm happy to do it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. And thank you, dear viewer and dear listener. Thank you for catching us. I hope you liked it. Let me know what you thought. Leave a comment wherever you're catching this. Leave a comment. Subscribe, rate us. Share it with your friends. Drop me a message. Let me know what you thought. And we'll catch you again in another episode. But until then, take care, look after yourself, and remember, change is always possible. And when you change your mind, you change your life. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Keith Blakemore Noble Radio Show, helping you transform your deepest fears into your greatest strengths. To find out more, please visit keithblakemorenoble.com.